back and we're going to discuss the IBOR reforms. I'd like to welcome the staff from Norwalk. It's now, I guess, a reasonable hour on the eastern coast of the United States, so Norwalk for this. But I understand Rihanna and Alex. Rihanna's going to start, and then Alex is going to talk about what we're doing, and then we're going to open up for questions?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Please begin.
So the way we thought we would run the session is to first have a look at the proposals that the ISB put out in our recent exposure draft on IBOR. I'll give you a bit of an overview of the feedback we've received on that as well as some of the other issues that people have raised for us to address. And then I'll hand over to Alex to give us an overview of the FASB's project, and we'll open the floor after that for discussion as there's such a big overlap, I think, between all of the issues. So as stated in the ISB's exposure draft, the ISB has been monitoring the developments around the replacement and the reform of the interest rate benchmarks in various jurisdictions. At the time that we published the exposure draft, based on what we've known at that stage about how the rates are going to change and the outreach we've done with our stakeholders, we've decided to split the project into two phases. And the first phase looking at the pre-replacement issues and the uncertainty around the timing of the cash flows, the amounts and the timing of those cash flows that are being hedged. And the second phase of the project would look at the replacement issues, so what needs to happen when the contracts are being changed to replace the one benchmark rate with another rate. On page 5, we've summarized the ISB's proposals in the exposure draft, and all those proposals really tried to do was to say, in this period of uncertainty where you don't know what your cash flows are going to be over the full contract life, either of the hedged item or the hedging instrument, there are some requirements in both IFRS 9 and IAS 39 that require a forward assessment of the cash flows and whether the hedge is still expected to be prospectively effective. And if we don't take into account the uncertainties, or we don't give relief from the uncertainties arising from the IBOR reform, then entities could fail hedge accounting in some circumstances. And the ISB didn't feel that discontinuing hedge accounting purely based on the uncertainties out of the reform would result in useful information for the user. So the exposure draft had three main proposals. The first one was to look at the highly probable requirement and whether the cash flows that you are hedging or that you've specified as your hedged item is still expected or to be highly probable, so they're still going to occur. The second one was to assess whether your hedge is still expected to be highly effective on a prospective basis. So looking forward, do you still expect this hedge to be highly effective? The relief in the exposure draft basically required entities to assume that their contractual cash flows will be the same. So in other words, ignore the change that might happen from the benchmark reform. Assume that you're still going to have the same benchmark rate in doing both those forward-looking assessments. The third proposal was around the requirement to assess whether a non-contractually specified risk component, so if you've got a fixed rate instrument and you want to specify the benchmark rate as the rate being hedged, whether that component is separately identifiable. And the relief in the exposure draft says, well, you only need to assess, for the purpose of the benchmark rate reform, you only need to assess whether that rate is separately identifiable at the inception of the hedge. So you don't have to reassess it under these circumstances over the life of the hedge. So that would mean once you've designated it and you were happy that it was separately identifiable, you can continue with that hedge without having to reassess that criteria. Now, the ISB, when we looked at when the relief has to come to an end, it was quite difficult to put a fixed date on it. And because there are so many rates around the world changing in different ways at different times, and you know, we don't have a complete picture yet of how things will change, we didn't put a fixed date at the end of the relief, and we said the relief will apply until the uncertainty from these cash flows are resolved. Now, that could either be when the contract is changed, but it could also be at different times, depending on the circumstances. the other requirement was that the relief will be mandatory. So if you have a hedge that is impacted, you are hedging interest rate risk and it's impacted by IBOR reform, then the relief has to be applied on a mandatory basis. And that was mainly done to avoid situations where entities could pick and choose which hedges to fail and maybe do a bit of earnings management along the way, depending on whether there's debits or credits they want to release. The effective date for the exposure draft was the, or will be, the 1st of January next year. And when we look at the feedback we've received, I think overall the proposals made in the exposure draft were very well received, and most of our respondents supported those proposals for the reasons that we set out in the basis. But of course it's subject to some drafting clarifications and some areas where they need a bit more guidance or, you know, asked us to rethink some of the proposals we've made. Now, most of those areas relate to the scope of the exposure draft and the way we defined which hedges would be impacted by this relief. And the only thing that people really want us to include or maybe think about is we've said it's only for interest rate risk when you hedge interest rate risk, but there's also if you've got a cross-currency swap and you might also be hedging foreign exchange along with interest rate risk. They just want to make sure that those hedges are not necessarily excluded from the relief because they are also impacted by IBOR. There was also just some clarification around how the relief will apply to our macro hedge accounting relationships, both on a cash flow and a fair value basis. And on the disclosure requirements, most respondents asked the ISB to just reconsider the volume of quantitative disclosure that they would have to give, and, you know, sort of the request was for more qualitative disclosures along with an indication of, you know, the extent that the entity is exposed to the IBOR reform, so maybe looking at the nominal values of the exposure. Now, in addition to all of the comments we've received on the questions we've asked in the exposure draft, we've also got quite a lot of comments around other issues that we need to think about, either as part of this phase of the project, so the pre-replacement issues, or as part of the next phase, looking at the replacement issues. And one of the items that would fall into the phase one amendments that we now need to finalize is just looking at whether we can give some relief from the retrospective effectiveness testing on those hedges. And the request is not to change the measurement or give people relief from booking the ineffectiveness through P&L, but it's more just to continue hedge accounting in the cases where you might fail the retrospective assessment in IAS 39 if you move outside the 80 to 125 range for effectiveness. So it's just continuing in the hedge, but while booking all the ineffectiveness. Some of the other items that was raised to us included whether changes to the contractual terms to replace the one rate with another rate and some ancillary changes following from that, whether that would be treated as a continuation of the financial instrument, whether it's a modification and whether it would result in a discontinuation of the instrument. And related to that, it's around making changes to hedge documentation where the hedge risk is now changing from one benchmark rate to another. Now, in response to the feedback that the ISB received, we have an additional meeting in August to try and finalize the phase one amendments as quickly as possible. But at the same time, we are also working on our analysis on some of these other issues that we need to address in the next phase of the project, and we will start those deliberations quite soon. And with that, Alex, I think it's over to you.
Sure, thanks. So I'm Alex Casas. I'm the assistant director overseeing the reference rate reform project. As Russ mentioned on the TV screen, we have the project team back in Norwalk. I don't know if people remember the TV game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, but that game show introduced this concept of Lifeline and phone a friend, and so that's who you see on the screen.
That's what your Lifeline.
That's my Lifeline. They're the ones that do all the work. I just take all the credit. And so if I get any difficult questions from people, I'm just going to deflect it to them. So hopefully they're paying attention.
They're smiling.
So I'm going to start off big picture, just to set the stage and talk about the progress we've been making and where we go from here. And then afterwards, I'll dig a little bit deeper into some of the technical aspects of our proposal. So I'm going to start off with the timeline that's on slide 2. And, you know, one thing I'll mention up front, as you can tell, this format is a little bit similar to what the ISB's team kind of has in their deck as well. So it kind of shows that we have a pretty good collaborative relationship. And I mean that seriously. We've had some good touch points with the project team over the past several months, and we look forward to continued collaboration as we move forward. So, you know, we started working on, the board has had reference rate reform on its radar since as far back as 2014. And, you know, that was back when the Fed convened the Alternative Reference Rate Committee in the U.S. to identify a replacement to U.S. LIBOR. And at that point in time, the board was working on its targeted improvements to hedging and derivatives. And at that point in time, the Fed reached out to the board to ask us to consider the upcoming changes to LIBOR as part of that derivatives project. And so that's where, you know, early on, it was on the board's radar. And, you know, some of the decisions that were made in the derivatives and hedging project, you know, kind of address some of the concerns that the Fed raised. You know, the board last year added, you know, SOFR as a benchmark rate for fair value hedge purposes. As part of the derivatives project, the board also changed cash flow hedging, and specifically, instead of having the benchmark rate notion applying to cash flow hedges, now it's, for a cash flow hedge, it's the contractually specified rate. And so regardless of whether it's LIBOR or one of the new rates, whatever the new rates are, those would qualify for hedge accounting relief. And so some of those issues were resolved last year. And so now, you know, last fall, the board added our phase two project onto the agenda. And so that's what we're currently focused on. And what we've done since last fall is outreach with stakeholders to identify and prioritize the issues associated with reference rate reform. And that's what led to the items that were raised at the most recent board meetings where we came up with the proposal, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. And so at last week's board meeting, the board voted on moving forward with exposing our proposal. And so what we're doing right now is we're in the process of drafting up that exposure draft. And the plan will be to issue it sometime in September for public comment. And ultimately, the goal will be to have a final standard issued towards, you know, the end of the year or early next year, most likely Q1 of next year. And the reason we're targeting Q1 of next year in large part is, you know, as we have on the timeline here, we're trying to go in tandem with the market. And there's a particular important milestone happening in the market with respect to ISDA. You know, they're finalizing their amendments to their 2006 ISDA definitions and protocol. And so the request that we receive from stakeholders is once ISDA finalizes that, which is expected to be towards the end of this year, at that point, people will start modifying contracts, and so we want to have the relief in place for when that's going to happen. And, you know, before I move off this slide, I just want to mention that issuing this final standard does not mean we stop working on reference rate reform. This is a multi-prong project for us, and obviously reference rate reform is not an accounting initiative. It's really a regulatory initiative that will continue to go on for the foreseeable future, and so we will continue to monitor, you know, what's happening in the market and adjust accordingly. So I'm going to move on now to the next slide and start getting into some of the technical aspects of the proposal. And so I'm on slide 3. And, you know, so this project is very different for us in that it's, the focus is more on reducing cost and complexity, you know, taking costs out of the system and not letting the accounting be an impediment to people transitioning away from LIBOR to new rates. And so the first board meeting was on June 19th. And before I get too far into the the guidance and the relief. I want to talk about this word relief because it's a rather provocative word. And what I'm finding is when I talk to people about that word, it kind of means different things to different people. And so I want to be very clear up front. And when we talk about relief, we're not talking about giving people a free pass. We're not waiving the accounting analysis. It's really what we're talking about is relief from an operational accounting standpoint. So think of it as, you know, when you're evaluating a modification, you have all sorts of steps in a decision tree that you navigate through to reach a conclusion as to whether you have a modification or whether you have a new instrument. And so all we're doing is we're trying to cut out some of those boxes from the decision tree to reach a certain conclusion. And then once you reach that conclusion, you follow whatever the normal accounting is for a modification. So it's more facilitating the analysis and removing some of the calculations that might be in place. The other thing I want to mention up front is the relief is entirely optional, and we also will have an expiration date to the relief, which I'll talk about later on in a later deck. And, you know, we're making this optional because there's no deficiency in the U.S. GAAP literature around modifications. You know, there's already gap on how do you handle a modification, what do you do with that. And so really what we're trying to do is help, particularly those instances where there could be high volumes of modifications, and try to have a more simplified evaluation that can apply to a large volume of modifications. And the other thing I'll mention, so the option is applied on what we call a topic-by-topic basis. And so for people who may not be familiar with what we mean by topic, it's really just how the accounting literature is organized. So an example of a topic would be loans. Another topic would be debt, or another topic would be leases. So it's based on the accounting literature and how the guidance is grouped, and then you would elect it at that level. So I'm going to now move on to talking about scope. So the first thing that we had to think about is what contracts would qualify for the relief. And it's actually quite simple, which is, does the contract reference LIBOR or another IBOR that's going away? And if it references that rate, then the contract is in scope. And then the next question is, now that you've identified a contract that references a rate that's going away, what do you do to that contract? How are you changing that contract? And so the focus that we had was on, you know, the critical terms of the contract. And by critical terms, I'm referring to those terms that affect the cash flows, you know, the calculation of the cash flows, you know, the timing and the amount of cash flows. And we recognize that once you open up a contract for modification, most likely the lawyers are going to get involved, risk management's going to get involved to introduce, you know, covenants, you know, reps and warranties, whatever the latest and greatest standardized language is, that will probably make its way into the contracts. And we didn't want to preclude people from making those enhancements to the contracts. And so anything that doesn't affect the cash flows of the contracts, you know, would be permitted. And so to qualify for the relief, as long as the critical terms, as long as the changes that you're making to the critical terms are essential or related to reference rate reform, then you get into the relief. So then that raises the question, what do we mean by essential or related? So things like that would qualify would be the index. So if you're replacing LIBOR with another index, say SOFR, you probably need to incorporate some sort of spread adjustment to capture the difference between the new rate and the old rate. You probably need to modify the reset period or the reset date, the repricing calculations. So what I mean by that is moving from term to overnight. So those types of changes would be permissible. In terms of what would not be permissible would be things like where you're doing an entire new underwriting or adding leverage factors, or you have a significant extension to the maturity date. So you're making changes to the contract that are somewhat independent of the just simply changing the index that's being referenced there. And so now that we've determined what contracts would qualify for relief, so the next question is, well, what is the relief? And so that takes me to the next slide, so slide 4. So the relief can be segregated into two buckets. So one bucket is contract modifications, and then the other bucket is hedge accounting, which I'll talk about in the next slide. So starting off with contract modifications, which will likely be the most pervasive issue, at a basic level, if you meet the criteria, you treat the contract as a continuation of the contract. So that's really all we're saying with the relief. So keep doing what you're doing. In the case of a loan or a debt instrument, that basically just means you adjust your yield prospectively to capture the new rate. And so, you know, today in existing GAAP, if you're a preparer, you have to go through what's called the 10% test, where you calculate the cash flows under the old instrument and the cash flows of the new instrument, your present value of those, and then if the difference is more or less than 10% apart, you would use that to determine whether you have a new contract or an old contract. And so essentially what we're doing is we're replacing that quantitative work that could be burdensome for a large volume of transactions with a more qualitative assessment. And so the board decided to provide explicit relief for debts, loans, leases. And then we had the question, well, what about areas that are not explicitly stated? And so the board developed a principle which basically says for modifications not explicitly stated, you would allow, you would treat the modification to be considered as a continuation of the contract. And so part of the reason we're doing a little bit of both with having a principle and explicit guidance is really to avoid questions or having people needing to document certain conclusions. So if it's black and white that, you know, here's the relief, it's easier to operate. And that's based on feedback that we receive from stakeholders. Just like what I said earlier about the types of contracts that would qualify for relief, what the guidance will say is, you know, if it says LIBOR, you're in, or if it's referencing a rate that will be discontinued. And you might think, well, if we have that principle, we don't need to explicitly state the rates that are going away. But again, the feedback we received is for areas where we would put in principles or have some judgment involved, it then requires companies to document their conclusions, get audits on those. And so really, part of the goal here is to have the guidance be as easily interpreted and operable as possible to the best we can. And so, all right, I'm going to move on to the next slide, which is slide 5, which is the decisions reached at the last meeting. And so now I'm going to get into hedge accounting, which is, you know, very specialized and technical. But I'm going to keep this very simple so that a broader audience can follow along. So when we talk about hedge accounting, there's two things to keep in mind. So one is you have all this evaluation work that you're doing off to the side to assess for effectiveness. So you have all this modeling that you do, or all this work that's off to the side. And then separate from that, you have the actual accounting entries, you know, the debits and the credits. How do you account for a hedge, and how is that hedge depicted in the financial statements? And so what we're changing is the accounting evaluation. We are not changing how hedges are depicted in the financial statements. So the debits and credits associated with hedging will continue on. And the reason I want to emphasize that is we're not hiding ineffectiveness. If there's ineffectiveness, that is going to be visible in the financial statements. So, for example, if you have a cash flow hedge where you have a SOFR-based derivative and a LIBOR-based cash instrument, that basis differential is going to be reflected in the net interest margin that companies are going to be reporting. And so to the extent there's ineffectiveness, that will be visible. We're not taking any portion of ineffectiveness or whatever and either ignoring it or carving it out to some sort of other category. Really, what we're doing for hedging relief is we're basically saying, keep doing hedge accounting. Don't unwind your hedges and start, you know, marking to market your derivatives and all that stuff. Just keep doing what you're doing during this interim period and continue to apply the normal debits and credits that you do for your hedges. And so, you know, if you think about a cash flow hedge where you have, you know, a derivative and the cash instrument that are referencing an index, today they're both referencing LIBOR. At some point in time, let's say you replace one of those instruments to SOFR, say, but the other one's still on LIBOR. During that period of a mismatch, that's where the relief would come in. And the relief just basically says, ignore that temporary mismatch. But as soon as you modify the other item, then you revert back. So once both items in the relationship have been modified, you would then no longer be in the relief, and you'd be following your normal hedge accounting. So the other thing that the board decided on last week was on transition and the related disclosures. And so in terms of transition, what the board decided is for the guidance to be effective on a prospective basis. So basically what that means is any modifications or hedge evaluations that are taking place that after the guidance is issued. So let's say we issue the guidance in Q1 of next year. Any modifications that take place in that quarter and thereafter would be eligible for the relief as well as your hedge evaluation for that quarter. And then from a disclosure standpoint, to the extent companies elect the relief, they would disclose what areas they've elected for the relief as well as the reasons for electing that relief. So the last thing I'll mention is the expiration date. So what the board tentatively decided right now is that the relief would end on January 1 of 2013. And 2023. I haven't had much sleep these past.
What you meant? You said it wasn't retrospective.
2023. So the logic there is LIBOR is expected to be gone by the end of 2021, and so that gives a year for any slippage. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, this project will remain on the agenda, and so we will continue to monitor. And if we need to, we would revisit that date and potentially push it out if necessary. I know, as Rihanna mentioned, for the ISB's proposal, I believe, you know, you're using the term of until the uncertainty is resolved. The reason we came up with a hard date is basically to avoid that question as to what does it mean the uncertainty is resolved. You know, we tried to make the guidance as explicit as possible, as easy to interpret, and try to minimize those areas where there could be a lot of judgment and diversity. And because the more judgment that you put out there, it just opens it up for more questions down the road. So in terms of next steps, as I mentioned, exposure draft out in September, and then look to finalize in the winter time.
Thanks, so, Alex. Anything else, Rihanna?
No, that's it.
Sue Lloyd?
Thanks. And this is very interesting for us because I think a lot of the things that FASB have already started looking at are things that we've got on our to-do list for our phase two. So thank you for doing some pre-work for us. I just wanted to check my understanding of one thing and to ask you how you thought about another thing. So on the option to apply the relief, so if I understood properly, somebody needs to make a choice on a topic-by-topic basis, so they'll either apply the relief or not, and it would apply to everything that's in that topic?
Yeah. Yes.
And so does that mean, and you used as an example, sorry, I should know how your topics work better, but I don't, so...
Okay, neither do we.
So, for example, if you've got a loan, if you've got loans, would you be making effectively a decision on whether you want to apply the modification relief for all your loans?
Yes.
You might make a different decision for bonds.
Technically bonds are a different topic.
And is the decision that you make for modifications different to the decision that you make for hedge accounting? Is that a different topic?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
And then the decision you make for hedge accounting, that's an all-in as well, so you'd either apply the relief for all your hedge accounting relationships or none? That's not hedge by hedge?
No, that's on a hedge by hedge basis, because the underlying hedge accounting is on a hedge by hedge basis.
Okay, so I've got two questions now then. So
do you have a decision tree?
So when we did our phase one, we decided to make it mandatory. And that was partly because we didn't want people to make a choice on a hedge-by-hedge basis, and that was because we were concerned people might cherry-pick when they wanted to recycle accumulated gains and losses out of OCI into P&L and to get particular effect. So I guess I'd be interested in how you thought about that.
I think because you can do that today, where you can always elect to discontinue a hedge relationship on a hedge-by-hedge basis, we didn't want to introduce a different way of locking people into their hedges.
Okay, which is interesting, because under IFRS 9, they can't just stop, so that's the difference. Once you're in, you're stuck in.
But we haven't seen cherry-picking with that today. Certainly the ability to cherry-pick's out there, companies aren't doing it.
And then just a question on the scope of the relief. So one of the things that we're starting to think about is how we might be able to do something which is, you know, sort of along the lines of what you're doing in terms of trying to work out if there's a set of parameters when we'd be sort of comfortable to say, essentially, we're happy for you to treat this as a continuation of the same item that you're accounting for, so there's no sort of spikes in P&L and all of that sort of stuff. And one of the things we've been thinking about is, you know, what the scope of that would be, and thinking along the lines of what you're doing here in terms of what's changed and what hasn't. And I guess one of the things that I've been trying to think about, partly based on conversations with some of the people in the market, is that there seems to be a relatively widely held view that there's likely to be value exchanges in this negotiation. It's likely to be the case that people won't necessarily be value neutral between the contract they had and the contract they end up with after the negotiations, for the simple fact that people will take the opportunity to see if they can get a better deal, and the banks might need to try and encourage some people to make the changes to their loans that they may not want to make. So I think if people change from one benchmark to another, that's sort of fine, but do you have anything in there about how big a spread adjustment is an okay spread adjustment before you start thinking that it shouldn't be in scope, or are you just not going to focus on that? You focused on the maturity point, so I wrote that down. That's helpful.
Yes. I mean, so the guidance talks about for the spread differential between the new index and the old index. One thing we do specify separately that would not be allowed would be like changing the counterparty credit spread, which I know is not your point. At the end of the day, I think it's...
Say they can't change the spread?
Well, if you're resetting the counterparty credit spread to whatever the current credit spread is, then that seems more like a new underwriting decision.
You can add a basis spread, and we're not regulating what the spread is. Just to answer your question.
Okay. Right. Thank you. That's helpful.
No more questions? Martin?
Yeah. On modifications, I have not really understood what the relief really is. Is the relief that you say you don't have to prove if the changes would qualify for modification, but then you have to simply apply the modification rules to if these transactions are impacted by this benchmark change, or what is the relief? Or is the relief that you don't have to apply the normal rules? Because I'm hearing people saying here in our region saying there's a lot of work to do all the modification for all of our contracts, and we should not apply the modification rules. we should simply then continue with a new interest rate and not doing kind of the discounting based on this new rate and then using the old interest rate and all this kind of a lot of too much work, and they want to have more relief. And so I have not really understood what the detailed relief is, what you have decided, and if there was not by constituents ask for more relief.
Yeah, so, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, we are still going to have rules. We just have a new set of rules that are easier to apply.
Okay.
So we're not waiving the accounting analysis.
But to perform the modification is then simpler. You come up with new rules which makes the modification in practice more simpler.
Yeah, that's our objective. So that's why we came up with this qualitative criteria.
Not only to assess if it qualifies
as,
for a
as
modification
the assessment.
Or derecognition. That is not the only relief. It is only to apply then the rule. It's also you.
Yeah, so the qualitative criteria we're putting forth would then reach you to, if you meet it, you then conclude you have a modification, and then you follow whatever the existing accounting
existing
rule is
okay.
for modifications.
Well, for example, loans, if you meet the criteria, you don't have to do the cash flow test.
That's right. So think of it as an off-ramp. So if you've got, I modified my contract. Now, normally I'd have to go through the steps to prove that it meets modification to get to modification counting. What we're saying is, okay, you changed the contract. Did you meet this specific criteria qualitatively? All right, you get an off-ramp around that and go right to contract modification.
But then to apply this modification rule, you don't have a change. You don't give any further relief. Then you have to discount present value calculation and all this. Yeah.
Alex, another way, if you meet the gating criteria, you don't have to terminate the contract.
Yes.
Terminate the...
That's right.
Don't need to treat it as a new instrument.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd account for the cash flow effects when they happen.
So can I just make sure I understand? So you would say... So usually if you change a contract under our literature, and I think yours, you need to say, okay, is this change such a big deal that we have to treat it like a new financial instrument, or can we continue to treat it as an old one? Mm-hmm. You're basically saying those normal tests don't have to be applied because if these particular criteria apply, you can assume that it's a continuation of the existing financial instrument.
Yes.
Is that what you've done?
Yes.
Yes. Because as long as what you're changing is what we've specified, then it's not a big deal,
yeah.
Basically.
Because
yeah.
at the end of the day, what we're saying is I've got a contract. There was a bunch of accounting noise that happened, and I still have that contract. So what we analyzed was, what's the criteria to prove that all of this stuff would just be accounting noise to just get you here? And we removed that accounting noise.
And the benefit is the volume of transactions that some companies would have to go through is enormous. So anything we can do to mitigate that noise in the system.
Absolutely.
Both from the preparer and from the user side. What good is it to say, oh, we're terminating all these contracts and we're going to start all over again? It doesn't provide users with a lot of good information.
But is then the modification impact, is that the people have sent to discount then the modified cash flows with a new discount rate and then using the original?
Just the new floating rate. You just changed from LIBOR to the new floating rate, I presume, yeah?
Just changing then the...
Just flows through over time.
Okay.
Just recognize the cash flows.
Just like you'd updated LIBOR, yeah? Except you've updated it to a new rate, yeah?
Yeah. With hedge accounting, think of hedge accounting, it's sort of the same thing. I've got a good hedge. I change something. Presumably at the end, I'm going to have a good hedge. Take out the accounting noise.
Yeah. Okay.
Hedge accounting might be a little bit more relief-like in that we're suspending effectiveness testing.
Absolutely.
And so there are some that you might say, not in its entirety, but partially, that you would say, I mean, the risk was it may not qualify during that period, and I think we're saying assume it qualifies.
And I think that's the biggest thing I can see that's the difference between what we've discussed so far and what you have discussed so far, because in phase one, doesn't mean we'd do the same in phase two, but in phase one, at least what was in the ED would say that if one of the hedging instrument or the hedged item got updated before the other, you would need to look at whether those two are a good match to continue your hedge accounting, whereas you're saying don't worry about it until you've ultimately changed both contracts.
And I think that's because we believe the, my understanding is the derivatives will be updated most likely before the underlying contracts?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there will be...
The fallback provisions of the derivatives.
Yeah.
And Alex, once you have gone through all this, there will be value transfer, likely to be value transfer, and then you've got a decision, flush it through or spread it out, basically.
That's with a fair value hedge, though.
With a fair value
hedge. Yeah.
Okay, anything else on this topic? Okay, we're running a little early, so it's time for turn over you for Goodwill.
All right.
Great. Okay, so thanks, Alex.
We'll now have a wait for the staff to change.
Russ, ours are on the screen.
What?
Our team is on the screen. For Goodwill.
I was in the eight.
They will be on the screen. Hey. They're not on the screen now.
They're going to be on the screen. Wait for them to be on the screen.
I
might need the email.
That's what I'm doing.
Blocking paper.